Commentator Jeff Moyer is dealing with a life-threatening situation, although the life at stake is not his own.
The group email arrived in January. It was a plea from a close friend for his adult daughter, Julie, who needed a kidney. I was gripped by a terrible dilemma. Julie's blood type was my own. If I volunteered and was accepted, I could save this woman's life. But I didn't want to go through the transplant surgery. I was afraid of the pain, of the loss of control. I began turning over every rock, looking for a valid reason not to offer. Much to my relief, a local transplant center told me that at 61, I was a marginal candidate. But then Julie's transplant center said I wasn't marginal at all. So I signed up. Deep inside, a part of me hoped that I would flunk out and a perfect younger donor would be found. But the few other candidates didn't pass medical muster. I went through a series of rigorous medical evaluations. One doctor demanded a nuclear stress test to prove my heart could be shocked back into life if it stopped during surgery. A social worker questioned my motivation. Challenged at every turn, I found myself wanting to overcome these obstacles to be selected as the donor. More importantly, I began empathizing with Julie. And rather than flunking out, I passed all the tests with flying colors. The day I received the news that I was accepted, I was genuinely elated. Now, very soon, after our final medical exams and last-minute blood-matching tests, I will play my part in this remarkable sharing of a human resource. Since receiving that group email last winter, Julie and I have become friends. I have found a new courage and steel, maybe for both of us. Now, together we wait.
Jeff Moyer is a writer, musician, and disability advocate in Cleveland. He's going to check in with us again after the transplant surgery. Some of the national teams at soccer's World Cup have found their currency falling. Italy does not look like the defending champion that it is, and France's team appears to be imploding. NPR's Mike Pesca is following the story from Johannesburg. Hi, Mike.
I thought you were going to say the English continue to be pounded.
No, I would leave those lines to you, of course.
Thank you.
Although I mostly wanted to ask about, or at least at the beginning, ask about Italy, which is, as we said, the defending champion, but just managed to draw against New Zealand, definitely not a defending champion.
Italy usually starts out slow. So if you told me that they were going to have two ties, or as they call it in international soccer, draws to begin the tournament, it wouldn't be that shocking. The shocking result was that it was against New Zealand. Now, New Zealand was the lowest team to qualify for the World Cup. The South African hosts are actually ranked lower in FIFA rankings, but hosts always get an automatic qualification. Many smart gamblers thought the best bet of the World Cup was that the New Zealand wouldn't score a goal in the entire tournament bet, but they managed to tie with Slovakia in the last minute of their first game, and then the 1-1 draw against Italy. And if you want to argue it, it is true. The Italians had so many more chances and they hit a post. But the one goal that Italy scored was based on a fairly poor referee's decision to give a card in the box, which resulted in a penalty kick. It was the greatest day in the short history of New Zealand soccer.
Is there actual danger that Italy might not make the second round?
Yeah, if they lose to Slovakia, which has proved to be the weakest team in their group, they might not win. And the only reason we would say that that could happen is because they have not been playing well. And in this World Cup, there have been so many upsets and so many things that we think couldn't have happened, like Spain losing and Germany losing and teams that are supposed to be doing well, not doing well at all.
And then there's France.
Which is a category unto itself. Now, the French losing wasn't so shocking. In fact, coming into this, most French thought the best they could do was to acquit themselves, not embarrassingly, but they have, in fact, not played well, and their loss against Mexico, 2-0, was downright embarrassing because the players, this is a sports cliche, but it is true, and it has been borne out by what has happened since, the players quit. And what happened yesterday was that the players pretty much revolted en masse. They refused to play for their coach. And their coach is a strange cat by the name of Raymond Dominic, and he believes in astrology and help picking his lineup. He says, I don't want to put a Leo at striker because he's going to do something to embarrass us. all of France, all of the team was not behind the strange decisions of Raymond Domenech. The only people who supported Raymond Domenech were the sports federation. The players revolted. The players walked out of practice. I mean, this is just a French revolution, and anyone who knows history knows how bloody those can be.
Well, let me just make sure I understand what's happening here. Are the French going to play?
They are going to play. They were staging a one-day protest, and they have a final game against the host South Africa. And it's a pretty good chance that no matter what happens in that, neither team will move on to the next round.
Mike Pesca, I want to ask about another thing. Every time there is an American game, you can tell in Washington, D.C., because the bars here are allowed to open early in the morning with the time difference, and you walk past a bar and there will be hundreds of people in there at 10 o'clock in the morning. When's the next time that's going to happen, and what are we expecting to see?
The United States, again, plays on Wednesday. They play for their lives. If they beat Algeria, they advance to the next round. If you had told the Americans beforehand that would be the situation, one game against Algeria to advance, they certainly would have taken it. And let me tell you, in the last couple of days, a Dane, a Chilean, a Honduran, I could think of 15 different nationalities have come up to me and said, what was with that disallowed third goal?
Oh, yeah.
Because they think I know, and I don't know, and no one knows, but it has made the Americans the sympathetic darlings of the world. Everyone's fascinated and thinks that they got jobbed on that last call.
So you get to drink in all that sympathy as an American.
Yeah, it's nice. It's a strange feeling for once, right?
Mike, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
That's NPR's Mike Pesca in Johannesburg.
Now, from a discovery under the sea to a discovery on a ceiling. Not just any ceiling, the most famous ceiling in the world. The Sistine Chapel ceiling and Michelangelo's fresco, The Separation of Light from Darkness. Two researchers at the Department of Neurosurgery at Johns Hopkins University claim that hidden within that famous painting is an anatomically accurate painting of the human brain. They say they found it in God's neck. Well, Dr. Rafael Tamargo is a professor of neurosurgery and is co-author of an article in the journal Neurosurgery about this discovery and joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Mr. Siegel.
And this painting on the Sistine Chapel is huge. Where exactly is the image that your study is about?
Well, this fresco, The Separation of Light from Darkness, is immediately above the altar. And the neck of God in this fresco has attracted the attention of scholars because it has very unusual anatomical features. And as we studied, you know, the lines that Michelangelo had included in the neck, we were surprised to find that if you follow these lines, you can actually draw an anatomically correct view of the brainstem.
Now, this is these lines have been seen by others in the past, perhaps not neurosurgeons, as a goiter, say, or some kind of growth on God's neck in this fresco.
That's correct.
But you see an anatomically correct drawing of the brain. Would Michelangelo have been able to draw an anatomically correct rendering of the brain?
Yes. Michelangelo himself started dissecting cadavers when he was 17 years old. So he probably had the ability to, and the material, to carry on multiple dissections and eventually sort out the gross anatomy of the brain.
Well, if Michelangelo actually had the ability to make a very good drawing of the brain, what would his motive be for hiding such a drawing inside the figure of God on the Sistine Chapel ceiling?
I think that Michelangelo might have been somewhat reluctant to advertise his anatomical dissections. You know, at the time, cadaver dissections were viewed with ambivalence by the population and, in addition, by the Vatican. And I think he had a lot of anatomical knowledge that maybe he wanted to express but didn't have a venue in which to do so. And by incorporating this image of the brain, first, he was able to display his knowledge of anatomy and also sign, so to speak, the fresco in a unique way. And he's known to have had a very playful streak and sign his works in unique ways.
Now, I appreciate that this is a scholarly article in neurosurgery. It feels, though, a little bit close to, you know, stories about how somewhere in the $20 bill is some encoded message that we would all get if we looked at it right, or the Da Vinci Code, or one of these things. How deeply convinced of this are you, and to what extent are you willing to play with the idea?
Well, I'm very convinced. Prior to the article, you know, my colleague and I, Ian Sook, showed it to other neurosurgeons, neuroanatomists, and without saying much, they spontaneously recognized the brainstem. So I think it's real.
Well, Professor Tamargo, thank you very much for talking with us about it.
My pleasure, Mr. Siegel.
Dr. Rafael Tamargo is professor of neurosurgery at Johns Hopkins University, and you can see God's neck for yourself at our website, npr.org.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Beth Raymer's new book, Lay the Favorite, is about guys sitting in front of screens, taking and placing bets, playing the odds, and living it up. And here's the refreshing thing about it. These guys are not on Wall Street. They're in Vegas and Curacao and Costa Rica. Lay the Favorite is about sports gamblers. Beth Raymer, not long out of college in Florida, somehow tumbled into a world of men who made a livelihood out of their love of sports, their talent for math, and it seems their inability or aversion to do anything else. Their gambling is barely on this side of the law, and sometimes not. And Beth Raymer attaches herself to them. And let's just say that in this very funny and smart book, gambling turns out to be not the least wholesome career that she was toying with. Beth Raymer, welcome to the
Hello.
Program. To give some sense of your relationship to gambling, I wonder if you could read a story about a visit you made to a casino with your family when you were very little.
Okay. It was my first time in a casino, but certainly not my father's. In the early years of my parents' marriage, he and Mom flew out to Vegas a couple of times a year and stayed at the Tropicana. In 1976, a nun from the orphanage called my parents and told them there was a two-week-old baby girl available. My parents had married young and had been trying to have kids for 12 years. They had adopted my sister 3 years earlier. Now there was a new baby from a different family. Were they interested? Mom cried yes, but as soon as she hung up, Dad reminded her of the tickets they had to see Elvis in Vegas that weekend. The next morning, they picked me up from Catholic Social Services, named me after the Kiss song Beth, which was playing on the radio, left me with my Aunt Bonnie, and took off to Vegas. On the evening of the show, Dad found himself at the blackjack table in the middle of a hot streak. Despite my mother's pleading, Dad refused to quit playing, and they missed Elvis. 22 years later, during their divorce, Mom repeated this story in front of the judge as proof that my father was a problem gambler.
So you were not a stranger to the problem of gambling when you tumbled into this whole thing.
I wasn't.
Tell us about the gambler named Dink Heimowitz, whom you worked for.
I met Dink Heimowitz in 2001 when I moved to Las Vegas. Someone introduced me to him, and Dink had moved to Las Vegas a couple years before. He had been a bookmaker in Queens, and he got arrested, and he had to serve time in a halfway house. And it was during his time at the halfway house where he won a lot of money gambling. And so he made enough money to move to Las Vegas to be a professional gambler, and he opened his gambling office, Dink Inc., and he hired me as an employee.
And in Las Vegas, what he was doing as a gambler was legal.
Yes.
So what did you do for him in Las Vegas?
Well, I worked at his office. I would make bets, and I would go to casinos along the strip and off the strip and make bets on his behalf.
And you describe some of what people are saying at Dink Inc., as they're following umpteen different sports events on television and on clickers and everything.
Yeah, a day in the life of that office was really hectic. I mean, September would be NFL, U.S. Open, the pennant race, preseason hockey, college football. Plus, Dink's always playing party poker on the computer. We're playing Jim Rummy. We're betting on horses. so there was always a lot of action.
And he would come out ahead of all this? I mean, he was just typically winning, or was he losing his shirt all the time?
Oh, no, he was coming out ahead. Dink is so rare in that he's made a 30-year living gambling. You don't meet guys like that.
Then you tell the story later of how you went to work in Curacao, in the Caribbean, for an outfit that was taking bets over the Internet.
Right. Then I meet someone by the name of Bernard Rose, who was a friend of Dink's. And Bernard, also after having gone through a rough time, tried to go straight, tried to work for his father's candy business, just couldn't stand the boredom and the monotony, went back into gambling, and he takes the risk to move to Curacao and open ASAP, All Serious Action Players, his offshore betting office.
All Serious Action Players.
Yes.
And he's taking bets, supposedly with his own methods here of calculating odds.
Right.
Part of your job there was reviewing the recorded phone calls that gamblers made. I want you to describe that.
So basically, when you call and make bets with an offshore sportsbook, all of the phone conversations are recorded, because then if anyone has a claim on Mondays when we're doing all of the accounting, if someone says, oh, no, I didn't bet on the Red Sox to go under 8, I bet on it to go over 8, we can go back and check the bets and listen to what bet was actually placed.
And at one point at ASAP in Curacao, you described the books, and it wasn't as if this was a highly sophisticated piece of software they were using. Lots of scribbled bits of paper
with
numbers.
No, I mean, that's the thing. It's, you know, these guys, they were bookmakers in the 60s and 70s, and they're used to doing things on a different level. They're not the most technologically sophisticated group of men. Yes, they're mathematically inclined, they can talk about odds, but when it comes to running a business and having to deal with money wires and using computer programs, they are pretty ignorant about it. So very often they write bets on paper plates.
On paper plates.
So the accounting got really messed up.
But the bet on a paper plate could be tens of thousands of dollars.
Oh, yeah.
Now, we should clarify here that what you did, this isn't like what Gloria Steinem did many, many years ago, becoming a Playboy bunny for a magazine article. This was really your life. This wasn't a bunch of decisions just to write about it.
No, no.
And so some explanation is required here. You're a very good writer, a very insightful and funny writer. How on earth did you find yourself working in such a strange demimonde? Why not some kind of straight work that might have been a little bit more stable and legal?
Oh, gosh. I don't know. Honestly, I was just never attracted to stable jobs. And I think that's something that the people in my book and I have in common, which is the addiction to living a life of endless possibility. Lay the favorite is a gambling term, which means bet on the team most likely to win. And the title's kind of ironic, I guess, because it's saying invest yourself in the outcome that appears most certain. And I and the people in my book have an almost pathological aversion to certainty. We crave uncertainty. And gamblers take every uncertainty in life and turn it into a game, which is why they do things like take bets on the results of their prostate exams.
Just if there's somebody out there who's willing to bet the other side, why not?
Oh, huh? Always.
Well, Beth Raymer, thank you very much for talking
thank
with us
you.
About your book. The book is called Lay the Favorite, A Memoir of Gambling.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
And when we talk about the financial crisis, we often hear about inadequate regulation, greedy bankers, irresponsible consumers. University of Chicago economist Raghu Rajan points to another cause, social inequality. He says disparity in income is one of the fault lines that contributed to the recent financial earthquake. Rajan's new book is called Fault Lines, and he joined us to talk about it.
This wasn't the typical boom and bust that characterizes the housing economy. This was a boom where the poorest people and their houses went up the most in price and came down the most. And I point to income inequality. The problem in the United States is that incomes for people with college degrees has grown much faster than incomes of those only with high school degrees. And the reason really is that technology implies that people today require much more of an education in order to the jobs that are available. But the supply of the educated is not keeping pace with the demand for them. As a result, people who have the education are growing much richer than people who don't.
So you're not talking about the very rich. You're talking about middle class, maybe upper middle class, versus people who are what we might call working class.
Absolutely. And I'm saying the people in the working class need a better education, but education is very hard to fix. So with the American middle class slipping behind, there's immense pressure on the politicians to do something. The buttons that were easy for them to push was more credit, because some of the institutions that offer credit, especially in housing, were affiliated or controlled by the government. Now, what I want to argue is that housing credit became a palliative, which had support from both the left and the right. And so you had President Clinton talking about the affordable housing mandate. You had President Bush talking about the ownership society. But both pushed government agencies and the quasi-government agencies to send a lot of money towards low-income housing. And that did push up housing prices a lot at the lower end and eventually led to a collapse in those prices.
You draw comparisons to history. In particular, I'm thinking the 1910s and 1920s, the years leading up to the stock market crash that kicked off the Great Depression.
We had another big transformation towards the end of the 19th century. And again, at that time, you had a rise in inequality and you had the farmers falling behind. And at that time, the farmers pushed again politically for more credit. And the outcome was an expansion in banking, a tremendous expansion in banking in the early part of the 20th century. And in many ways, the farm sector was a subprime sector of the Great Depression. There were lots of farm foreclosures. The Grapes of Wrath is a classic book on that phenomenon. And many banks who had lent to these farmers again went out of business. So this is not a new phenomenon in U.S. history. And instead of doing the things that are needed to make society transition towards a better distribution of income, we use credit to fill the gap.
You've just spoken about one fundamental problem or fault line. What would be another one?
Well, the second fault line I want to talk about is the fact that the recovery from recessions has become much more prolonged, especially in terms of jobs. Because the United States has very narrow safety nets or very limited safety nets, there's a tremendous amount of anxiety created amongst the unemployed. There's huge anxiety, while in Spain, they endure 20% unemployment without a revolution or without the kind of anxiety that we have here. So the point I'm trying to make here is the nature of U.S. recessions were compatible with the U.S. safety net in the past. Quick recessions, short safety net. Now what has happened is that with the recessions, at least the jobless part of it, lasting much longer, the safety net is inadequate. And we have to think about this, whether we can afford the kinds of policies that come in to substitute for the safety net, policies that expand the deficit widely, policies that lead to very low interest rates for a sustained period in a somewhat futile attempt to get firms to hire.
Raghu Rajan is a professor at the University of Chicago's Booth School of Business. His new book is Fault Lines.
Another technology story now, this one from North Carolina. On the Camp Lejeune Marine Corps base, large reflective rectangles line the rooftops of many homes. They're not some high-tech military gadget or satellite dish. They're solar panels for heating water. In fact, so many have gone up in one neighborhood that it's quickly becoming the largest community in the continental U.S. to heat water with energy from the sun. From member station WHQR, Catherine Welch reports.
An American flag flies from the porch of Sergeant Kirk Paulson and his wife's light brown house. The Paulsons live on the corner of a cul-de-sac where every home on the block has a 10-by-4-foot solar panel smack in the middle of the roof. The solar panel is a new addition to the Paulson home, one they're proud of.
And it's kind of like a milestone in our history books for the Marine Corps, for state of North Carolina, and for the continental U.S. So I feel very proud of that, that we're conserving it for our children's children's children.
Eventually, solar panels will sit on top of 900 homes in this Camp Lejeune neighborhood. Recently, the Paulsons sacrificed a little privacy and let some energy officials and North Carolina Governor Bev Perdue into their home to poke around the utility closet.
If any home has a roof that gets some sun, does it matter the direction of the sun?
Michael Shore says no. He's the president of FLS Energy, the company behind the solar panels. He says they act like a greenhouse, heating a fluid that runs down pipes inside the house, transferring heat into a 40-gallon water tank with temperatures reaching 180 degrees. Shore says solar panels are one of the most cost-effective ways to generate energy.
And we have this myth in this country that renewable energy is expensive. And here Camp Lejeune and the housing company are saving money through solar. So I think we are really in the midst of a shift on how our nation gets its energy.
Shore says energy from the sun can heat three-quarters of the water used in a typical household. Marines living on base don't pay utility bills. So who's saving money? Camp Lejeune, sort of. FLS buys all of the solar panels and equipment and sells the hot water to the company that runs Camp Lejeune's on-base housing. FLS has done this before, and it's with populations of individuals who don't have to foot the water bill themselves. It's tacked solar panels on top of hotels, college dorms, prisons, places that use a lot of hot water.
So the military was, you know, the next and maybe the best frontier, just because there's so much hot water that's used on a base.
It'll cost FLS $6 million to hook up all 900 homes on base to solar water heaters. For the average civilian homeowner, the out-of-pocket costs can run as much as $7,000. Sergeant Kirk Paulson and his wife Jamie have only had their solar hot water heater for a few weeks, but they say so far there have been no surprise cold showers.
When we're taking a shower or whatnot, the water is always nice and warm. We want a warm shower, you know, the cold day. There's always warm water available.
After conquering the Marines, FLS Energy has its sights set on bringing solar water heaters to families in the other branches of the military. For NPR News, I'm Catherine Welch.
This is NPR.